This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson. In 1971, a new term entered the language, bioethics. This new field of philosophy deals with the ethical questions that arise in the practice of medicine and human biology. My guest, Dr. Ruth Macklin, is a pioneer in the field. She was part of the first team of philosophy professors to teach a course in bioethics in the early 70s and work in hospitals with physicians to help guide them in their work. Raising questions of ethics seemed unnecessary in the field of medicine, a profession assumed to be ethical by its very nature, but new technologies have changed medicine and create a new layer of uncertainties. Amniocentesis, life-prolonging equipment, surrogate motherhood raise questions about the right to die, allocation of scarce resources, and the rights of a mother and her fetus. The need to discuss these issues has led some hospitals to create a staff position for an ethicist. Ruth Macklin is the ethicist in residence at Albert Einstein College of Medicine and its affiliated hospitals in New York City. Macklin is also the author of several books, including her most recent, Mortal Choices, Ethical Dilemmas in Modern Medicine. I asked Ruth Macklin how the doctors react to her presence as an ethicist in their hospital.
I think that requires both a little bit of elaboration on what I do, which is not give answers so much as help doctors think things through, provide an ethical analysis, try to clarify and structure the ethical problems that they confront. But I don't come in knocking on the door of physicians or other health professionals and say, here I am, I'm your ethicist, I'm here to solve your problems. In fact, I believe that if thoughtful people, professionals who devote their life to the profession and who do want to do the right thing, if they're unable to come up with clear right answers, then there are no clear right answers. So as far as my coming in and thinking I know the answers where doctors don't, that really doesn't describe quite accurately what I do. Doctors are puzzled very often, and they're not sure what the ethical problem is. They disagree with a colleague, and they may end up in a shouting match saying, well, that's your opinion, or that's my opinion, or that's what you learned from your religion, and they can't talk anymore. One of the things that we who think and write and do research in this field are able to do is to try to come up with some ethical principles that apply and to try to indicate wherein lies the ethical problem.
Well, the ethical problems in medicine nowadays are rampant as the technology continues to expand. So in whose interests do you actually work?
I hope I work in the patient's interest. And what I mean by that is not that patients and doctors are often or always adversaries, but what much of this field of bioethics and the movement that that underpins it is about is empowering patients. Now, what I mean here is that sometimes a patient may wish to refuse or forego a treatment, or a family may seek to do so on behalf of a patient who's no longer capable of speaking for himself or herself. Doctors may be in a quandary, either thinking that they have an obligation to treat because that's what medicine, their training taught them, or they may be fearful of some unnamed, unknown, unenvisaged legal liability. Hospitals, for their part, and by that I mean hospital administrators, are paranoid, virtually paranoid, that some malpractice suit's going to come out of the woodwork or that some zealous prosecutor is hovering about waiting to swoop in whenever a plug gets pulled. So in advocating for the patient, or if you will, in acting in the interest of the patient, I and most of my colleagues look at this array of forces and interests operating and ask, what's best for the patient?
How do you advise in a situation where there's a conflict between the health of the mother and the health of the fetus, and one has to be saved, or only one can be saved? Has this condition shown up in your experience?
Well, I think you have to be a little more specific. I mean, it's not like it was generations ago when in childbirth, for example, the choice was often between the life of the mother or the life of the emerging infant. Today, it's rare that it's the life of the mother versus the life of the fetus. But it may be, and it actually frequently is, a pregnant woman who refuses a recommended medical procedure of some sort that is judged to be for the benefit of the fetus. And it's not a choice between her life or the life of the fetus, but it is a choice between her right to informed consent and informed refusal and the medical interests of the fetus. So that's usually the conflict. A couple of quick examples. It could be a cesarean section, quite common these days, because they can do a lot of fetal monitoring, and that when fetal distress of some sort is identified by fetal monitoring, it may be that the physician recommends a cesarean section. The woman may refuse because she doesn't want to have the surgery. A cesarean section, a birth by cesarean section, places the woman at about a fourfold increased risk of death during childbirth. So a woman may refuse for rational reasons. Sometimes women refuse cesarean sections for religious reasons. They're opposed to cutting. And sometimes it's just simple fear. There are other circumstances as well. Sometimes a woman needs a blood transfusion. If she's a Jehovah's Witness, she may refuse the blood transfusion for herself, even though she may be putting her own life at risk as well as that of her fetus. And there may are a variety of other circumstances. For example, a pregnant diabetic woman who may be non-compliant on her insulin or other recommended medications may risk the life or health of the fetus. Now, I didn't yet answer you which side I come down on, but I will. It's a troubling and, indeed, these days, unpopular position, but I believe in the rights of autonomous adults. Pregnant women are autonomous adults, just like non-pregnant women and non-pregnant men. Therefore, the rights of a woman to refuse a medical treatment, I argue, should extend even to the time when she's pregnant, and even if it might risk the health or the life of her fetus.
This notion of autonomy of the patient seems relatively recent. In part, it goes along with the assumption that the patient is going to be informed about what has to be done.
That's right.
I mean, sometimes doctors just operated without telling the patient what was involved.
That's right. And in fact, the notion of autonomy as we speak of it today in the field of bioethics is a relatively new notion. However, the ethical and indeed legal requirement that physicians not only inform a patient but get consent or permission before performing a surgical procedure goes back to a case, Schlondorf versus New York Hospital, all the way back in the first decades or so of this century. I think it was 1912 or 1913 that case was first argued. And what the ruling was in that case is that a doctor who cuts into a patient, essentially performs a surgical procedure without the patient's consent, is guilty of assault. However, it wasn't until the late 1950s and more recently that there was a legal requirement that patients had to be informed, not just get their permission, but inform them about the nature of what would be done, the procedures, the risks and the benefits, and any alternatives they may have. So the notion of informed consent is relatively recent. And beyond that, the concept of autonomy that you just mentioned really goes hand in hand with the modern movement in bioethics, which was essentially granting patients rights of self-determination.
When a choice needs to be made, when a patient is, say, under anesthesia and cannot be informed, I mean, is this when you step into the operating room or a lawyer steps in to act for the patient, or does the doctor then have to make a judgment at that time?
Yeah, I think you're probably talking about an emergency then. I mean, if it's in the operating room, I go into the operating room is when I need surgery on myself. And lawyers have no place in the operating room because what do they know? In fact, an emergency, whether it be in the operating room, in the emergency room of a hospital, or on the wards of the hospital when an emergency arises, the emergency is actually the only situation that does not require informed consent. There, the doctor uses his best clinical judgment, acts first, and asks philosophical questions later, and that's as it should be.
Say a doctor opens up a patient and discovers that there are a couple of clumps of cancer in different places and did not plan to operate for cancer but takes the cancer out anyway. Is that an example of an emergency, or is that an example of a doctor exceeding what is assumed a doctor should exceed nowadays?
Well, what did he open her up for?
Well, I'm trying to remember. You actually had an example in your book.
Yes, I did. It was a minor surgical procedure. And in the course of taking out an organ or a damaged organ or doing a minor procedure, the doctor notices that the patient has cancer. And in that episode, the doctor reasoned it was in the patient's best interest to have the cancer taken out because the risks of anesthesia and of undergoing the surgical procedure a second time outweighed, in the doctor's balancing of these, outweighed any benefits to the patient.
This was a patient in his or her 70s, as I recall.
Yes, yes, an older patient, and it's always riskier with an older patient. I mean, I think what the doctor did in that case was not terribly wrong, because it was benefiting the patient by removing the cancer, but it did violate the precept of informed consent. And if we take principles like that seriously, doctors cannot rely on what they long relied on, which is presumed consent. There is no presumed consent. The patient has to be asked and give informed permission each time a new procedure is done.
My guest is Dr. Ruth Macklin. She's the ethicist in residence at Albert Einstein College of Medicine and its affiliated hospitals in New York City. She's written a book about her field called Mortal Choices. Say you have a baby that's born with spina bifida and has a prognosis of a very painful life if a neonatologist is able to resuscitate and keep the child alive so that it's able to thrive for a while. What are some of the debates? What are some of the issues that get discussed? I assume there's the doctor urging mm-hmm. to keep the child alive. There might be parents saying, let's let the child die an early death because it would be too painful to live with.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the natures? What are some of the positions that come up in a case like that?
Well, at one position, at one extreme, and I'll give several extremes and then name the principles. One extreme is virtually a right-to-life position, which is to say no one can or should make judgments about quality of life. Let me not call it right-to-life, but sanctity of life. It's sometimes called a vitalist position. And according to that view, neither the parents nor the doctors nor ethicists nor anyone should have the authority to decide that an infant who can live and may live a life that has some pain and suffering, no one should have the authority to decide that no life is better than some life. Now, at an extreme position, whether with spina bifida or some other condition, that position says always treat. You never have the option of not treating or of treating less aggressively, which is the words physicians use. At another extreme is the view that the parents ought to decide. It's their child. They're the ones who have to rear it. They're the ones who'll have responsibility, moral, financial, emotional. And so they should decide, and whatever they decide is what ought to be done. That position essentially says there's no right answer, but the only right answer is who decides, and it's the parent. The view that I take, and a lot of my colleagues take, is essentially a patient-centered or infant-centered view. And we presume that the parents are the decision makers for their newborn, unless they're making a decision that's clearly against the best interest of the infant. Not just possibly against, but clearly against the infant's best interest. That, of course, requires that we try to define what's the infant's best interest. And that's not easy, because that's the very point that's under debate here. Is it in the infant's best interest to continue life? I and very many of my colleagues come down in cases of spina bifida on the side of life, largely because when you look at children and even adults who have that affliction, they live meaningful lives. They can work. They go to school. Many are highly educated. And given a life that can have meaning, even though it might have pain and suffering associated with it, a life that can have meaning where there's not such severe neurologic damage that the human being could not enjoy human pursuits or recognize loved ones, then with spina bifida, that always comes down on the side of life.
These are cases that would try a couple, a family, to try to decide and come to any sort of resolution about. Have you had to make choices on your own for your own family in that regard?
No, not yet. We did in my family, however, Also, my mother and I signed our living wills at the same time, and we were both healthy. I mean, she's much older, and I'm middle-aged or thereabouts. And because we were both healthy and there was no imminent illness or fatal disease lurking in the background, it was actually a happy family occasion. And since I and my brother and my own two adult children were there, we kind of laughed and joked about it. But I think as far as living wills or involving family members, the best time to make those decisions is while everyone's still healthy and when everyone can communicate. What all too often happens is families have not discussed these things, and a family member becomes ill. The adult children come running when the elderly parent is there, and no one knows what the patient would have wanted. And that's really the key to decision-making in medicine, what the patient now wants, or if the patient can no longer participate, what the patient would have wanted.
Insurance companies, employers, and even the state of Oregon are now making medical decisions based on the expense of a procedure. And I believe the state of Oregon is choosing a form of medical triage, listing priorities of, you know, is it going to be better for our community, our society, to spend $250,000 on a transplant operation, or is that $250,000 going to be better spent in a prenatal care? Is this sort of lifting decisions from the world of ethics into the world of the bottom line as far as medicine is concerned?
Yes. And what's worse, and I think that listeners should certainly be aware, what's going on in the state of Oregon is rationing for the poor. This is the state-based Medicaid program in Oregon. And what it's doing is further increasing the gap between the kind of health care that's delivered to haves and have-nots in our society. People with money can still pay. So far, we haven't yet heard of Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and the major medical carriers rationing in the same way. I mean, perhaps that's next down the line. But what the state is doing is deciding how much of the taxpayers' money should or should not go for this or that procedure. And indeed, they're rationing medical care, but not for everybody in the state of Oregon, just those who have to rely on state assistance. So there's a manifest injustice, in addition to the problems of rationing generally and looking at the bottom line rather than health care as a need. There's also this injustice of giving people unequal access to what the medical system can provide.
I'm struck by the information that patients now have and the kinds of choices that patients are able to make about their own lives. And it seems that part of your work, as I understand it, is trying to keep doctors and other people in the health profession from second-guessing what a patient wants, that you can come up with a number of ideas of prospective courses of action, and that you might be surprised by what a patient will actually want. Let me, I guess, be a little more specific here. You recount the experience of a patient who came into the hospital who was a drug addict and was accidentally given an overdose of methadone, 10 times the usual dose, suffered cardiac arrest. A physician immediately recognized what the problem was, resuscitated the patient, and then there was a dilemma about whether to tell the patient what had caused the cardiac arrest. And I wonder if you can explain the different attitudes of physicians and how you tried to bring about another point of view about what to tell the patient.
Well, it's always a problem when some error or mistake has been made. The standard, I think the traditional and standard response is, what good would it do now to tell the patient, this is a general response, not specifically in that case, what good would it do now to tell the patient that we made an error? Not only might the patient sue, and that would be a problem, but the patient would lose faith in doctors. The patient would lose confidence and would perhaps not enter hospitals in the future. You can't undo the wrong that was done or the error that was done by telling the patient, and you may only create worse harm or worse problem. Therefore, the argument is it's better not to tell. On the other side there's the argument about whether patients have a right to know, particularly when something was done that harmed them, and whether or not the rights of information in the medical center require that. In the case you referred to in the book, it was complicated by the fact that the physicians thought that, or argued, that if this patient were not told that what happened was medical error, that it was the fault of the doctors, the patient would believe, or would probably believe, that he had done it to himself. And when a patient believes that by taking an overdose or doing something and almost losing his life, that that could happen again, that may shock the patient into changing behavior very radically and no longer taking drugs or doing whatever the harmful behavior is. Well, there's another side. I mean, when I come in, I try to present all sides to these issues. But I also tried to point out in that case that the patient could have more trust in physicians if the patient knew that there was an error, but that physicians, first of all, informed the patient and then were able to recognize the wrong done and save the patient's life. So one doesn't always know. One can assume what patients may think or what people believe, but there's no way really of knowing what people will believe until one sees. I mean, people are surprising all the time.
I know people who've checked into hospitals sometimes feel that hospitals are run for the benefit of the medical profession rather than the patients, and that there's a process of depersonalization that goes on. Everyone gets in the same gown. The doctors call the patients by the first name, and the patient has to call the doctor by the formal title. And this trend of advocating patients' rights or awareness of what's going on seems to be reversing that in some way.
Well, there's some hope that it will reverse that. Unfortunately, from where I sit, I see new forces coming in, and I see doctors and patients as allies in a cause of trying to decide consensually and determine what's right for patients. What's happening now, and I think this is a very recent development, is hospitals are not so much run for the benefit of doctors as for the benefit of the hospitals and the hospital administrators. There are layers upon layers of administrators. Doctors themselves are often not empowered or authorized to make clinical decisions that they would have made and in fact did make in earlier times. There's a new occupation that infects many hospitals known as risk manager. You know that term?
I've heard the term. I think I'm sure you could explain it better than I could.
A risk manager is a person, sometimes a lawyer, but very often not a lawyer, who's there essentially to pour water on trouble, to minimize liability for the hospital, minimize the possibility that somewhere, somehow, some unnamed, unknown person will come out of the woodwork and sue the hospital and all its doctors. Furthermore, risk managers are now concerned not only about lawsuits, but they're also concerned about the image of the hospital. As they say here in New York, and you probably have a counterpart, and every city probably has its own counterpart, we don't want to see this hospital in the headlines of the New York Post tomorrow. So the concerns now are those of publicity, public relations, minimizing liability, and even where they see liability as bad publicity, in addition to the possibility, even remote possibility, of some kind of lawsuit. These are interfering with doctors' decisions, with doctors' and patients' decisions, with families' decisions, since now it's not simply a matter of doctors being able to do something. They're paralyzed into inaction and will often say, we have to call risk management. So this is the latest, and that's in fact what my next book's going to be about, the intrusion into the doctor-patient relationship by this new breed of hospital administrators, lawyers, and risk managers. They're the ones now whom the hospitals are being run for. The poor doctors are as beleaguered as the patients.
Dr. Ruth Macklin, thank you very much for coming in and being a guest with us on Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
My guest has been Dr. Ruth Macklin. She's a medical ethicist at Albert Einstein College and its affiliated hospitals in New York. Her book is called Mortal Choices. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.